fought. It's like that in every state, in every precinct in the country, Dennis, and we're begging people to line up with us and to work with us to protect this election, and also to be poll workers and make phone calls. Now, in California, I'm repeatedly asked, how can I help in the swing states? And there are really good organizations. If anybody wants to know, contact me, solartopia@gmail.com, and I'll put you in touch with organizations that allow you to call in and make a difference. But Dennis, the details are mind-bending, and they every day there's a new crisis.
Okay, well, we're going to go on and bend a few more minds because I don't think that people are getting it. We are so close to getting Trump for another round.
Yes.
I mean, we all wish there was a better candidate, but
Biden at this point is not the problem. The only thing we want from Joe Biden is to not concede if he loses, God forbid, and not do what Hillary Clinton did in 2016, which is refuse to support recounts. There will be recounts in every precinct in this country that Trump loses. He will challenge every vote. And in the meantime, we have to guarantee that these votes, the people can come out, that they can vote, that they get their ballots. Now, in California, we're supposed to get our ballots in the mail if we're registered voters. But and that's true in Nevada and a few other states. But in other states, especially Ohio, Michigan, they're making it very difficult to get ballots. And so we have groups working on this. And if people
KABU
in California
Community Radio
want to plug
holds
in,
open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kabu.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KABU Community Radio is hiring a program director to manage our programming department. This full-time position requires proven experience in program directing, radio audio production, management, and supervisory skills with volunteers, with an emphasis on teamwork and a collaborative setting, and the ability to work under strict deadlines. KABU Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. The deadline to apply for this position is Saturday, October 3rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm/employment.
Before we jump into the show, we'd like to acknowledge our partnership with KABU. You can support community radio by donating today at kabu.fm/give. Support KABU now, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000 until September 20th, thanks to the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. Again, that's kabu.fm/give. Thank you.
Welcome to Margin. I'm Jake Bias. As you have likely heard if you're following along, I've been exploring stories from folks in marginalized communities across the Portland food industry, and have had a lot of success in discovering personal relationships that some individuals have been able to build in relation to food and their memories surrounding them. A lot of the conversations I've had touch on these themes of individual authenticity to self, and how it's a driving force in these culinary pursuits. An individual is relatively easy to get some perspective on in regards to their food traditions, probably because that perspective is rooted in their personal experiences. But living in such a vast and multifaceted nation as the United States, there has been an inevitable give and take in cultural exchange, which has some interesting effects on our collective cultural identity. While an immigrant or their children go through the process of acclimating to the culture here in the U.S. through assimilation or acculturation, traditions, customs, and cuisines exist apart from an individual, and it might be more accurate to describe the interplay of those elements as amalgamation. Cultural amalgamation is when two or more cultures blend together to make a new, unique culture. For example, Mexico and much of Latin America is the result of the combining of Spanish culture with that of native Mesoamerican tribes. Mexican culture continues to blend into U.S. traditions to this day, as it has significant influence on the people and customs across the Western United States. Natives of the West will know that Spanish language is a common option taught in school, and many people in the U.S. grew up eating and loving Mexican and other South American dishes. Understanding the history that influences a culture can give you a deeper appreciation of many of the Latin dishes that we know and love. It could also shed some light on the ways that we have molded dishes into cultural amalgams and created new foods here in the U.S. as a result of exposure to Latin cuisine. Arguably the most common of these, the burrito, in its most recognizable contemporary form is the result of U.S. cultural amalgamation. Although proto-burritos were likely piloted by street vendors in wheat-growing regions of Mexico such as Sonora, they didn't become a cultural force here in the U.S. until the Bracero movement brought more Mexican laborers to the country from the 1940s to the 60s.
Here is stoop labor in the literal meaning of the term, but the term is also applied to many of the toughest and least desirable farm jobs. For example, no stooping here. Yet, because citrus trees are thorny, more difficult to pick than other fruits, most farm workers avoid this kind of job. All such farm jobs, which are tough, dirty, or unpleasant, are generally referred to as stoop labor. Understandably, then, this is the only area in which the American farm labor supply falls short and is supplemented by Mexican citizens, sometimes called nationals or Mexican nationals. But the term most commonly used is braceros.
Today's Chipotle slung mission-style burrito is a significant departure from Mexican cuisine, and Mexicans can tend to be a bit rigid in the holding of their culinary traditions. But the U.S. readily embraced this overstuffed food bomb as they held no preconceived notions about the traditional application of Mexican ingredients. It was shiny and new. As the burrito became a staple across California, it was mass-produced and frozen to meet the growing demand. This was its ticket across the nation, thanks to the development of a commercially available variant invented by Duane R. Roberts of Butcher Boy Foods in the 1950s. This process of cultural blending is a living thing in the stories of immigrants and their families. I was able to get a chance to speak with a friend of mine early on in the Margin timeline about some of her experiences that relate to this process. Jenny Lay is an experienced manager in the advertising industry, and through our conversation, you'll hear how culture doesn't exist in a vacuum. I met Jenny while on a contract with Swift Agency, and we bonded quickly over some unexpected common ground.
Are you second generation? So your parents, like first generation, they came from Vietnam?
Yeah, my parents came from Vietnam, so I'm technically first generation, right? That's how it works. Yeah. First generation Asian American since I was born here.
Okay. Cool.
Is that incorrect? I don't know.
I think it's second generation because I think the immigrants are the first generation.
Oh, what? I thought it was just who was born first. Okay, maybe I'm totally wrong. I'm trusting you because you're a lot more knowledgeable at this point.
Oh, I don't know that I would trust me. I actually had an argument with my buddy Sam about it too. I was like, yeah, I'm a second generation immigrant. He's like, no, dude, you're first. And we, you know, actually, it's an argument we get into pretty regularly.
yeah. I guess it's debatable. But yeah, my parents came from Vietnam separately, and they met here, and then my brother and I were born here.
Oh, dope. How did they meet?
Mm-hmm. They met in high school. They went to Cleveland High School together.
Really?
And they met there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they've been in the Portland area the whole time, or?
Yeah, they both started in Portland, and they just have never left. So, they met over at Cleveland High School, which I think is adorable.
that's so interesting. Like, they're, you know, to have like an immigrant story that starts in two different places, and then like. You know, because typically that's not the way you hear it. It's like they meet in the home country and then come over together.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's how it was with my parents.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. When did they come? Like what year did they come?
So my mom was pregnant. So I'm technically an anchor baby.
Oh my God.
Yeah. My mom got pregnant in 1982, and that's when they moved, and I was born March of 83.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
Gosh, how scary must that have been for her to be moving to a whole different country when you're pregnant? I can't even imagine.
I think about it a lot. Like, I think about, like, when I was 19, like, I couldn't do anything. You know, I could...
Yeah.
I didn't even separate my whites from my colors. You know what I mean? Like,
I feel that. Yeah. I remember when I was like 23, I remember being like, oh my gosh, at this point, like, if I was my mom, I would have like escaped a country and like started completely over. I would have had two kids at this point. I'm just like, my gosh, I'm so irresponsible at this age.
I really like feel the same way. And like thinking about my dad, like what was going through his head as a 19-year-old, just, I'm going to leave all my family, everyone I've ever known, and move like halfway across the world to Oregon, mm-hmm. and just start over just because, you know, shit's bad enough in Mexico that we need to get out of here.
Yeah.
It's
mind-boggling.
Yeah. Really. Like, I mean, I'm stronger than me for sure. I wouldn't be able to do it.
Oh, 100%. I'm with you on that. That's why, like, whenever I think about just the things that they've gone through, I'm just like, how have you like managed to do that stuff in your lifetime? It's crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, you grew up in Beaverton, yeah?
Yeah, grew up in Beaverton. I was born in Portland, and then I think like a couple months after I was born, my parents moved out to the Beaverton area,
mm-hmm.
and then pretty much just like grew up in the Beaverton Hillsboro-ish area. I went to school in Hillsboro, but lived out in, like, you know, Aloha, that little nice little pocket between Beaverton and Hillsboro.
Yeah, yeah.
Slowly that people disappear. Don't really believe is real.
It's funny. My address is it's a 97003, and it's technically Beaverton, but this is Aloha. It's like the Aloha area.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really
Do you ever
weird.
Like have packages shipped to you and they're like, you'd put in Aloha and they're like, do you mean Beaverton? And it like corrects you?
Yeah, it tries to.
All the time.
Yeah. What high school did you go to? Because I went to Century.
Yeah, same. Century too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, we talked about this.
Mm-hmm.
I have a memory like a goldfish. What's your relationship like with your folks? Are you guys pretty tight?
Yeah, I would say we're pretty close. You know, like growing up, I feel like there definitely was always kind of a little bit of a cultural, I want to say cultural barrier. I don't know if that's the right terminology for it, but it was definitely kind of hard for me to kind of connect with my parents in a sense, because I kind of didn't really understand where they were coming from. And sometimes they didn't really understand where I was coming from, just because we just grew up so differently.
Yeah.
But now that I'm older, I'm definitely like really close with them. I mean, I see them every weekend if possible. You know, we probably talk on the phone like every other day. We're definitely pretty close.
Yeah. Well, that's significantly more than I talk to my parents.
It's probably majority of the time them just calling me and asking for favors or asking for IT help in some kind of way, but
uh-huh.
we do talk quite a bit.
That's good. And you said you have a brother?
Yep. I have one older brother. He's 2 years older than me.
Cool. Is he still in the area?
Yeah. He lives out in the Tigard area. So he's close by.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a pretty big family? Like, do your parents have siblings and stuff that are around? Or
yeah, I do have a really big family, but it's unique because most all of my family is actually in Vietnam. So when my parents came over here, they didn't really come over here with really any siblings or anything. So my dad is one of six kids, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh,
and
wow.
He has one half brother and one half sister here, but the rest of the siblings are in Vietnam. My mom is one of 13, and all of her siblings are in Vietnam. So I have lots of aunts and uncles and cousins.
Dang.
Back in the homeland. Yeah.
That's cool. So how often do you get a chance to visit your extended family?
I've been back to Vietnam, I want to say 5 or 6 times. Mm-hmm. Not as much as I would like to go. Ideally I would love to go like every year if possible, but just it's like the amount of time that it takes to get over there, it's not really worth just going there for like a week or two. You really want to go for at least like a month. And so I don't get to go back as often as I would like. I would say right now it's probably every 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's nice that you get that exposure. I have a lot of family in Mexico, and I think the last time I went back was like 8 years ago. So.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, like we get along great. I love them. They're fantastic, but it's a little dangerous, you know?
What part of Mexico are they in?
All over the place, but you know, Mexico City and coastal regions of Mexico, The state of Veracruz is where I have a lot of family, and it's just like it varies depending on what time of year and what's going on in the country. Like, not super safe. People get kidnapped, yeah. And you know, it's tough.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you? I mean, I never really asked. I know that you like are always clued in to like what food's good or where to get good dope food, but like, how do you feel about cooking? Do you like to cook for yourself or for your family?
I do. Yeah, I definitely love cooking. I always joke that like YouTube taught me how to cook just because it's just such a great resource for learning how to do like basically anything. And, yeah. You know, despite like my parents have a restaurant and growing up, they were always at that restaurant, and my mom's not that big of a cook. And so I never really like learned how to cook from her. So I kind of feel like I really like learned how to do most of my cooking from YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
I would say most of the meals that I cook are not authentic Vietnamese by any means. Although I want that to change. Like, I definitely want to learn how to make Vietnamese food. And so I'm trying, but it's just, you know, anytime that you ask anyone who's Vietnamese who knows how to cook, how to make anything, it's like, there's no measurements. They're literally just like, I don't know, just eyeball it. Just like throw it in there and like, wait for, you know, your ancestors to give you the word that you put in enough, you know, cardamom or like pepper or spice, you know? So, yeah. It's tough. I'm trying to learn from Brian's mom, how to cook some basic things and everything, but it's just like, you try doing it, it's just not the same. But you know, practice is what's going to make perfect, hopefully.
Well, and that's all it is, really. Like, my grandma's really big experiential cooker, and kind of like also not really big on measurements, so they do a recipe, you know, enough times, and so they get a feel for it. So you try it one time, and if it's way messed up, like way too much salt, then next time you try it, you use less salt. And
yeah,
after a certain amount of time, you just like get a feel for it. It's a cool way to cook because it feels so intuitive, but like you're not realizing how many of those little mistakes you've made over the course of how many times you've made the dish that perfect it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's funny too, because whenever she makes something that's like amazing, I'm like, this is so good. What did you do differently? She's like, I don't know. I really have no idea. I'm like, cool. So maybe I'll never have it this good ever again. So like, there's literally never writing anything down. But that's kind of what's nice about it. You know, it's just a nice surprise. The food's always good, but sometimes you have it one time, you're like, you have like a bowl of pho and you're like, holy crap, this is like the best one that you've ever made. And yeah. She's like, I don't know what I did differently. I just kind of just went with it.
Ugh. And like, it's even worse when you're like remembering something. Cause you know, like you change memories as you recall them. A fond memory, you recall it, and then you kind of like recall it over and over again, and it changes. So I feel like the memories get bigger and bigger until it's like super built up in your head.
Yeah. Oop. Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I had my grandma's cooking when she came and visited from Mexico years and years ago, and I just like, in my mind, it just feels like no cooking could ever be as good, and no, like, I'll get the same type of things at restaurants and I'll just be like, this is garbage. This is not, yeah, like my grandma's.
You know what's so funny too is that when we were in Vietnam earlier this year, we went to go try different restaurants, and like, we're like, okay, we really want to get this like bowl of bung rio, which is like, it's basically like a tomato crab noodle soup. It's like my favorite kind of Vietnamese soup. And we were like in Vietnam and we're like, this is going to be the best bung rio I've ever had in my life. And then we went and had it and I'm just like, I think my mom's is better, you know. I don't know if it's just because you're just so used to having it a certain way, and like someone cooks it a way different, and you're kind of like, you just expect that it's going to be like the best because you're like in Vietnam.
Yeah,
but I have not been able to find anything better than what our mom cooks. So,
well, and it could be also that like you've had a certain version so many times that you've developed the taste for it.
Yeah, totally. There's a funny thing, like when you talk to anybody who goes to Vietnam and you talk about pho, there's always an argument about whether or not pho in Vietnam is better than pho in the US. Ooh. Everyone always says that pho in the US is always better than in Vietnam.
I wonder why that is.
I don't know. I mean, I've heard that it's because the quality of the meat might be better here, or they like cook the bones longer or something along those lines. I'm not totally sure. I mean, it's not going to discourage me from trying pho in Vietnam, but it's always kind of a funny topic, sure, when you talk to somebody who's gone back.
Yeah. So you explore recipes, I'm sure, like with your extended family and stuff when you're out in Vietnam.
A little bit, yeah. I definitely like to talk about what ingredients they're using to throw things into my cooking and seeing how I can incorporate it. But I would say my cooking skills are like, they're pretty decent. I know like a good amount of stuff, but I think when it comes to like the crazy ingredients and spices and herbs, that's when I get a little bit like, it gets a little daunting for me.
Yeah, isn't it strange? Like the dichotomy of the different ingredients, even ingredients that like seem regular in those cultures. Like, you get them here and they're so, so different just because they grew in a totally different place, unless they're imported. And then in those cases, they're kind of like not as fresh.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's strange. Like, getting oregano from like a Mexican shop, it just tastes totally different than oregano you might get in Fred Meyer.
Oh, interesting. I wonder if it's like, is it like Thai basil and like regular basil in a sense?
It could be, yeah.
Yeah,
I bet,
yeah,
it's a different variety. So strange.
That is really strange.
So you went to Century. I mean, I went to Century, and Century's like smack dab in the middle of not a particularly diverse area of the country.
Yeah.
I know from my experience, I mean, I won't speak for you, but I know from my experience, it was like throughout my entire school experience, it was really difficult to parse like portions of your identity, and how they express themselves, even like potentially like finding a crowd that maybe had like similar or relatable experiences. Did you have anything similar to that, or can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have always talked about how I went to school in a predominantly white school, and I just growing up, I always kind of just like knew that I was different in a way, but tried so hard to not be different and not really accept my culture and my identity. And I always joked that when I was younger, like the last thing I wanted to do was like eat a Vietnamese meal when I went home. All I wanted to do was like eat a casserole. Like, I just really wanted to eat casseroles. And every single time I like met a friend and hung out with them during the daytime, I just would always be like, please, please. I would just hope that their parents will ask me to stay for dinner. And they're like making a tuna casserole for some reason. That was like the whitest meal I could think of. And I was like, God, I love tuna casseroles. I just really want to eat that. And like, if I go home, I can't get that. And I don't know what it is. I think I was just so surrounded by just not a diverse group that I think I tried so hard to assimilate and try to be like them that I just kind of never really like accepted the fact that I was an Asian person, or I kind of just saw myself as like, oh, I'm like your token Asian friend is kind of what I would always kind of say in a sense. But yeah, I don't think it was until I was in college that I kind of really started, and I moved away from home, that I really kind of appreciated my culture and really missed it, just because I think I was surrounded by a more diverse group. And I went to Oregon State, similar to you.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously when you're there, you're surrounded by a lot more diversity, which is good. Not a ton of diversity, but still a lot more than what is available to you in the Beaverton Hillsboro area. But yeah, I mean, it definitely was one of those things. I don't think growing up, I don't think I realized that it was an issue. I just thought it was kind of what the norm was. And so I'm glad that once I got older and kind of could surround myself with more diverse people, that it definitely was something that I was kind of assimilating to and not really accepting.
Yeah. It's so strange, like growing up as a person that's kind of like between cultures, like having a really strong tie in that connection to your parents and sort of like the world that they came from and how they identify. Like they definitely like grew up surrounded by their own culture, and so they don't really they don't necessarily have that sort of identity disconnect, or maybe they do, but I would say that it's probably a lot stronger in, you know, us potentially.
Mm-hmm.
Like my dad frequently says, you're Mexican, you're not from the US, you're a Mexican. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I mean, like by blood, that's very true. But the culture that I grew up in, it didn't reflect that. You know, most of the time when I was a kid, the people that I was surrounded by that I wanted to relate to or to accept me were white, you know, for
right.
lack of option, you know?
Right, right.
And I didn't immigrate here, so a lot of the Mexican kids, I didn't super relate to their experience. And also, my control of Spanish was a little weaker because, you know, subtractive assimilation.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I was growing up, it was always interesting for me because I always had asked my mom, like, I remember there was one specific time I asked my mom, like, can I paint my nails this color and go to school? Or can I just paint my nails or something like that? Because she had like a really like bright nail polish I wanted to use. So I asked her if I can use it. And she was like, no, you can't paint your nails because your teachers are not going to accept that. Like, they're not going to be okay with that when you go to school. And I was like, what is she talking about? I really had no idea why she was saying that. And I really believed her. And I went to school and I saw like all the other girls in my class had nail polish on. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? I'm really confused at why my mom said that. But I found out it's because she was thinking that, because in Vietnam, you know, when you're wearing a school uniform, you're not allowed to paint your nails or wear your hair a certain way. So she was really thinking that that's what it was like over here as well. Yeah. And I was just over here believing her. I was like, why are these teachers just so strict over here?
That's so interesting. I'd never heard mm-hmm. that before.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Just when you have a school uniform, there's certain rules for how you have to look and everything. And my mom thought that it was the same. It was the same for us over here. So that was kind of a rude awakening for me, being like, really? I'm not allowed to paint my nails? So
that's crazy.
Pausing here for just a moment to say that, like all good things, KBOO depends on community support. If you have a few dollars to spare, please consider making a donation at kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
Is there anything else like weird like that, that there was a little bit of a disconnect where your parents thought one thing and like the reality was a little different?
Oh, off the top of my head, I can't seem to think of anything. I mean, I definitely, everyone who is Asian American and, you know, grew up going to like a, you know, public school has always kind of dealt with that like lunchbox anxiety of, you know, bringing in a lunch from home and having people pick on you for what it is. Like my mom would always like make me things, or my grandma would always make me things. And I'd always just like bring it to school and like hide it because I was so embarrassed by bringing it in that I didn't want people questioning what I was eating or pointing out the fact that I was different. So I would always just go for the school lunches, which is that like nasty, you know, chicken tenders and who knows what. Really regretting that now, you know, but it just was one of those things that, you know, my parents were like, what's the big deal? You're just eating, you know, something with fish sauce in it. It shouldn't be that weird. But of course, you know, to kids, if they're smelling something with fish sauce in it, they're going to instantly think it's really strange. But that was definitely kind of a big struggle for me growing up. And it's one of those things that I don't think my parents or my grandma ever really could understand.
Yeah. You know, also especially considering that most of those kids had probably never had an interaction with fish sauce at all.
Right. Right. Yeah. And it makes me wish I can go back and be like, it smells weird, but just try it. It's so good. You know, it's like nowadays with adults and everything, people are definitely a lot more, most people at least are a little more open to trying new things. But of course, when you're a kid, it's a little bit different.
Well, and you know, we build these social circles around us with like-minded people. Even in that regard, you tend to have a little bit of like reverse tunnel vision because, you know, the people that we hang out with are, you know, potentially more multicultural or more open-minded, and so more apt to try like, you know, new things, new experiences.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think growing up and surrounding myself with more people like that has definitely helped a ton. So, and it kind of gives me the opportunity to be able to try new things as well.
So you learned how to speak Vietnamese at home before you went to school, right? Or did your parents speak in English? Like, how did that work?
My parents would speak in Vietnamese, but I would respond in English. So yeah. Not the best. I feel like my Vietnamese when I was younger was a lot better. But just as I got older, since I had an older brother, he spoke English. And so I just kind of latched on with him and just spoke English with him. But my Vietnamese is not as good as I would like it to be. And that's kind of what I'm trying to work on, you know, especially when you go to Vietnam and you're surrounded by nothing but Vietnamese people, you really need to figure it out for yourself. That's like the best way for me to personally learn, is just be completely surrounded by it. But growing up, my Vietnamese was all right. I feel like I know the basics to survive. Like I know how to ask for the bathroom, and I know how to say I'm hungry or I'm tired or I need to go to bed, but I wouldn't be able to have a full conversation with someone about my career and my aspirations and my goals and what I want in life. That's a little bit too much, but hopefully I'll be able to get there at some point.
Yeah, I feel very similarly about my control of Spanish. Like I can very much hold a basic conversation. Like I can say, hello, how are you? Thank you. You know, like ask for basic things. But when it comes to like explaining my emotional state, and you know, like that's what I default to because I tend to like being verbose about like my emotions and, you know, like a complex subjects. I just like to read about weird, you know, weird stuff and talk about it. I really would not be able to hold a similar conversation in Spanish. And it's strange because my parents spoke Spanish exclusively. So I learned Spanish before I learned English, and I went to school knowing only Spanish, and I had to learn English like super fast.
Yeah, yeah. Were you placed in like ESL program or what? What
yeah.
did you do?
Yeah, I was.
I have a really weird vivid memory of, I think I was either in the first or second grade, and they placed me in an ESL program as well. And I remember just sitting there being like, why am I in this program? I don't understand what's going on or why they're doing this. Just because to me, English was my first language. Vietnamese was my second. And I don't know if they just maybe made an assumption that I couldn't speak English that well. But I remember being in the program for a couple of weeks and never really getting an explanation. Granted, I was, you know, in the second grade, so they didn't really warrant, they didn't really give me one, but I remember being in that program and just wondering why I was in it. But yeah, that's tough. Do you feel like, when do you feel like you felt like you were fully comfortable with speaking English?
You know,
or do you remember?
It probably was like, you know, survival immersion. When it was like maybe first or second grade, you know, by that time, everybody's kind of talking a little bit and like their control of speaking is not super great. So I think that people just thought that I was a shy kid until I felt comfortable. And, you know, my parents were learning at the same time. So we watched a lot of TV. We still watch a lot of TV. And, you know, my dad was always a curious dude. So he was reading books and stuff and trying to learn as fast as possible. So it accelerated the process by which I learned English. And then once I had it, same deal with my sisters. They were just like, okay, I'll speak English with my brother. And yeah. Their, you know, control of Spanish was a little bit less also. We're all kind of like shaky. But I lived in Mexico for a little while, so that helped kind of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you ever live in Vietnam?
No, but I would love to. That's like kind of the dream. I would really love to live there at least for like, we always joke, like it'd be fun to live here for like 6 months or like a year or something like that, just to really like immerse ourselves in the culture. And I think the trip that we had planned earlier this year when we were planning to be there for about 6 weeks was, that was kind of the plan, is really just try to like throw ourselves in the middle of it and just try to figure it out and not have it, like not have my parents there to help us translate and do all these things. And like, let's surround ourselves with the people and like live as locals do and do as locals do. Mm-hmm. And that was really the goal. But of course our trip did get cut short, which is a bummer, but it was fun being there for 3 weeks and just trying to figure it out for ourselves. I feel like my Vietnamese definitely got like a little bit better while I was there. Granted, it was just 3 weeks, but it definitely helps for sure. But yeah. I would love to live in Vietnam. I think that'd be so fun.
Yeah, my time in Mexico, I look back on it really fondly. It was a lot of fun.
How long did you live there for?
It was like a few months, like 4 months, something like that.
Wow.
So it was, you know, like it wasn't a super long time. It was like summering in Mexico, but you know, it was enough time for me to really like pick up the culture very strongly. You know, it's just assimilation. You just, if you're around it, you're exposed to it, it kind of becomes second nature. So that helped quite a bit in like some of the nuance and stuff. But, you know, I kind of have lost it because I came back here and then got mm-hmm. acculturated here again. And so some things have stuck, but it was a lot of fun. It was good.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, I would love to do that. We always talk about just wanting to live abroad and stuff for a little bit, but you know, we got a dog, so that makes it a little bit hard.
Yeah. So tell me about your beef with the Portland scene.
You know, I feel like this has to be everyone's answer, is that it's just so white, right? Is that what everyone's probably saying? I'm assuming that's just what mine is, at least.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, it varies, but it's kind of some, you know, some variation of that. I mean,
yeah.
Any conversation I've had with white women, they don't say that, but.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. It's funny though, just because I don't think I realized how white it really was until, I almost want to say like 5 or 6 years ago, which is crazy. But I remember there was a time when I was down in California visiting some friends, and we were down in Pasadena at a bar. And I remember just like looking around when I was at that bar and just seeing nothing but Mexican people and Asian people. And I felt like I was just looking around and I'm like, this is like the most diverse building I've ever been in my life. And it just felt so weird. And I just remember even turning to my friends and being like, I weirdly kind of feel like I'm like a white person right now. Like, I feel like I'm kind of like out of place in this sense, because I've never been surrounded by this much of a diverse group before. It was mind-boggling to me. And that was kind of like, that's kind of when like the light flips, the light switch flipped in a sense. And I'm like, wow, I didn't realize how white Portland is until I'm in another city. And I really kind of see like how diverse other ones are.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough. Like, you definitely notice it. Absolutely. You know, just casually walking around when you're kind of like paying attention. It's like when your friend gets a new car and they tell you about that car. And so you're thinking of it, and then you see that car everywhere. You're like looking for it. You're like, oh, I saw like 3 Nissan Versas, you know, while I was driving around today.
Right.
It's that same kind of thing. And like, I was talking to Richard, and he was telling me you know, because you had talked about like how frequently Asian restaurants are winning awards and stuff around here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's absolutely wonderful. And Richard was talking about how like how hype he was after he, because he won Food Cart of the Year last year.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And he told me that the pretty much the weekend after he won the cart was the slowest weekend of his entire career.
Really? Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, he made the point that, like, you know, the traditional American diet, whenever people go out, they want, like, burgers, french fries, pizza, you know, American food. They don't think, like, I'm going to go get a pho duc biet, you know? I'm going to...
Right.
Mexican food, I think, is a little more accessible in that way, just because it's so common.
Right.
But... you know, definitely their first instinct isn't to go and seek something like new or fresh or different. And it's just not their culture's food. So it's so strange, like, because it's so white and because like you think about like how people are engaging with the food, like they just don't think to pursue diverse options like that.
Yeah, totally. And it might also just be intimidating in a sense, especially like nowadays when people are having to go and like, at least right now, with doing takeout and everything, instead of actually eating at the restaurant, you're having to think about all the like accoutrements that come with it and all the side dishes and the sauces and stuff. It probably just seems way too daunting to try to even like go and try that out. So I totally hear you out on that.
Yeah. What's your favorite oddball dish? I know you talked about that. What was that crab soup called again?
Bumrio.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, best.
Can you find that anywhere around here?
You can definitely find it at certain Vietnamese restaurants, but I mean, I don't ever order it when I'm out. I usually just get it from home with my mom,
yeah.
which is pretty awesome. But, yeah, they definitely have restaurants that do have it. There's a restaurant, called Javiel, H-A-V-L, and they also have a sister restaurant called Roseville. Have you gone before?
I have. Yeah. I've been to Javiel. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, they have like what, the two soups every single day, and they rotate through, and they have Bumrio on the Mondays, I think. I used to have the schedule memorized, but it's been a little while. But they have Bumrio on Mondays. I don't think I've ever actually had their Bumrio before, just because usually I'm not usually going out to eat on Mondays. But they have this soup. It's like a pepper pork ball noodle soup. It's called Bumap, but it's on Saturdays. And when they are open every Saturday morning, you will find me there. I can guarantee it.
Dang, sounds really good.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
What? So okay, you missed that clearly. So what other food carts, what other like eating out things do you miss just the most?
Just in terms of like what restaurants I miss the most, or just aspects of eating out?
Sure. How about both?
Okay. I really miss eating sushi. I feel like sushi is one of those things that just like, it's so much better when it's fresh and just like they make, you know, the sushi chef makes it and they bring it out and you can eat it right away. That's one thing that I really miss. I'm missing dim sum a lot. Dim sum is just one of those things that you just like can't, you can make it at home, but I'm not like, I don't have all the tools to be able to do it. And it's kind of scary at these times, just because with the landscape of how food is changing due to all of this stuff with COVID right now, it's like, I don't really even know if dim sum, how that's going to change, how dim sum works and how dim sum carts work and all that stuff. So that kind of scares me a little bit. So I definitely really miss that. But I don't know. It's like just going out and getting food and drinks and just happy hour with people is just how I connect best with people who I'm close to and people who are important to me. And I miss being able to do that. I mean, you can Zoom with people all you want to and, you know, have drinks over Google Hangouts. But I think having like a sit down face-to-face conversation with someone over a really good meal is just the best way to connect with people. And I definitely really miss that.
Yeah, I can really relate with you there. I'm super feeling that, you know, need to connect with folks in that way. And it, you know, it's hard, but we'll get it back at some point.
I hope so. We gotta go share a bowl of some soup or something over at Javiel once this is all over.
For sure. That sounds great. Well, I think we ran through most of what I got. You got any questions for me?
Oh man. pressure. Well, this is great. I'm super excited to hear that you're doing this. I feel like this has been an idea of yours and you've been wanting to do this for quite a long time, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's actually an idea I've been kicking around since I was at Oregon State.
So, yeah. I feel like we've kind of talked about this a little bit.
But I haven't really, I don't know. I kind of get in my own way, you know, like I'm like, oh, you know, like if I did this, it wouldn't be good, or, you know, like I wouldn't know how to do it, or I wouldn't know what kind of questions to ask. And I get kind of self-defeatist in that way, which, you know, I just need to knock that shit off, because
I think you were great. I mean, I feel like you're just very easy to talk to, which is good. You know what's funny is I didn't even realize you'd started recording. I thought we were just chatting.
Yeah, I've got 37 minutes almost. Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, one thing I kind of did want to talk about just a little bit was just kind of a cool story about how when my parents had escaped Vietnam, they both kind of had really different stories of how they escaped. My dad's story is, like, with him, he basically had escaped with a really small group of his friends on a small, like, motorboat of some kind. And I think they stole this boat or something along those lines, and they ended up just trying to leave the country as fast as possible. They ended up getting robbed by pirates at one point, which I'm like, I didn't even realize that was a thing, which is like crazy. They ended up washing up, I believe, in the Philippines, if I remember correctly. And there were some people who were on the beach there that happened to find them, and they ended up just going into like a camp while they were there in the Philippines until they could get sponsored to come to the US. That was obviously like very traumatic. My mom's story is definitely a little bit different in the sense that her older sister was the one who really wanted to escape Vietnam and come over here to the States, and my mom didn't really want to. But her older sister convinced her to go with her. And the night that they had escaped, they basically had like ran away and tried to get on this boat, and everybody was trying to get on the boat at the same time, and everyone was like pushing and shoving. And then my mom ended up getting on the boat, and her sister did not get on the boat.
So
my mom just like set off at sea, like had no idea where she was going to go. And my aunt ended up getting like found by the police and arrested and thrown in jail for a short amount of time. And so it's crazy to me to think that like both my parents had this crazy journey where they just had no idea where they were going to end up, and just hoping to like find a better life and just seeking that, and just truly not knowing what's next, and like how scary that must have been. So it's crazy just to know all it is that they've gone through. And it's interesting because when they both came here to the US, you know, my dad had worked at so many different restaurants and bars as a dishwasher and as like, you know, a waiter, and eventually he became a manager of a restaurant, which is great. And there was a point soon after he first came here that he was actually working for Bill Nato over at the White Stag building downtown.
Which is
really cool. So he was packing boxes for Bill Nato back then, and that building is actually the building that I got my first job in after I graduated. So that's like where I had my first college internship and I had my first job. And it was just kind of funny, like after I started working there, I told my dad where I was working. He's like, oh, it's so funny. Like right after I came to the US, that's the building I was working in, and I was packing boxes. And it was just like, wow. It was kind of really heartwarming for me to hear that in a sense, because it's like everything that my dad had gone through to come over here and like work to have a better life. It's like he was working in this building, packing boxes for someone, ended up opening up a business and putting his kids through college. And now this is like the first building that, you know, his daughter is working in, you know, as an intern and as her first job, which I thought was really cool.
That's really neat. Like universal serendipity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing.
You should have seen it the moment we realized it. We're like, wait, are you like right? Second and crew looks over there. We're like, yeah, that's the building. So that was really cool.
That's so funny. My dad used to work as a custodian. He used to clean that building.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool. How long ago was that?
It would have been in the 90s, like
okay,
early 90s.
Gosh, I just suddenly had a really vivid feedback or like vivid memory of when my parents were custodians back then too. I was in elementary school. They used to clean offices for PGE out in Hillsborough.
Oh, really?
And I remember I used to go with them and help them out. Yeah, I was like emptying trash cans and doing all that stuff. I completely forgot about that until you just mentioned it.
I did that too. I totally did.
You
that.
Did?
Yeah, my dad would take me with him to work. He used to work for this company called ICC for a guy named John Hammond. And my dad would take me to the office, and then they'd get their like cleaning contract jobs. Then he'd, you know, bring me along, and sometimes it was like graveyard. So I'd just be out with him sleeping in the van, or I'd go in to whatever school or whatever building he was cleaning, and he'd be like, here, go empty those, you know, trash cans or, you know, collect that or sweep this floor. And, you know, he just gave me little things. And it's interesting, like, those ways that we kind of like internalize our parents' process, or like it's peppered into our story like that.
Yeah.
How fun.
That was so funny. It was the same thing too. They're like, just go entertain yourself and go empty these trash cans. I'm like, cool. Okay. it was exciting for me. I remember like looking at all the desks there too at PGE. It was like cubicles, and I'm like, this is so cool. Hopefully someday I get my own desk, you know?
Yeah. You got one now.
That is
awesome.
I got one. Not in a cubicle. Thankfully not in a cubicle, but at that time I thought that was like the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah. Well, maybe someday you'll get your own cubicle.
Maybe. After all this COVID stuff, I think we're all probably going to get our own cubicle.
Yeah, probably. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me, Jenny. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me. This is so fun.
Yeah.
Jenny is an absolute joy, and coincidentally is your number one hype girl. You can find Jenny on Instagram by the handle at HelloJLE. Watch the show's feed at Margin Podcast on Instagram, and you'll be sure to catch more delicious food and engaging stories from the people of Portland and the surrounding areas. Find us where you find podcasts, iTunes, Google, Spotify, etc. And if you know of someone from a marginalized community that wants to tell their story, tell them to add us on IG or have them send us an email to margin.podcast@gmail.com. Until next time.
KBOO Community Radio wants to know what you care about this election season. We want to ask our listeners one simple question. What do you think candidates should be talking about as they compete for votes? Let us know by filling out our Citizens Agenda survey, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa prepaid gift card. The responses we get from our community will inform our reporting on the November election. We want our coverage to serve our community, and we need your help to make it happen. If you would like to participate and be entered to win $50, go online to bit.ly/KBOOSurvey. Again, that's bit.ly/KBOOSurvey.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the CWC Walk-In Expungement Clinic on Friday, September 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. at the Northwest Cannabis Club in Portland. The CWC Walk-In Clinic provides assistance searching for jobs, expunging records, and connecting to community resources and volunteer opportunities. Again, that's the CWC Walk-In Expungement Clinic on Friday, September 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. at the Northwest Cannabis Club, 1195 Southeast Powell Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. During this pandemic, KBOO is still here to serve the community, and we need you to be there for us. If you're able, please go to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution. Thank you.
Thank you. Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy miércoles 16 de septiembre del